Welcome to a special edition of Lord Abbott's Investment Conversation.
Now to coronavirus.
On February the 11th, 2020, the World Health Organization named the disease that would heavily impact world markets and redefine our daily existence on this planet.
And it is COVID-19. CO stands for corona, as you know. VI stands for virus, D for disease, so COVID.
As part of our 2020 Meteor Outlook, we've spoken with a group of our thought leaders about COVID-19, its impact on the healthcare sector, and the global economic recovery.
I am Matthew DeSico, portfolio manager on the Innovation Growth Equity team.
So I'm Heidi Lawrence. I'm an analyst here at Lord Abbott. I've been covering healthcare for about 15 plus years with a specialty right now covering life science tools and diagnostics.
Hi, I'm Samantha Shevins. I'm a healthcare analyst on the innovation funds at Lord Abbott. I've been covering biotech and pharmaceuticals for 20 years now on Wall Street.
I'm Davis Karandikar. I'm the portfolio manager of the Lord Abbott Healthcare Fund and also an analyst on the growth equity team. I've covered medical devices and healthcare services for over 20 years, starting in 1999.
My name is Marley Gatti and I cover healthcare on the taxable fixed income side. I focus primarily on providers, managed care, and services across the three major asset classes in fixed income, and leveraged loans, high yield, and investment grade. I've been covering the sector since 2001.
As you can imagine, with a combined 75 years experience covering the healthcare sector, the group is laser focused on four key initiatives that they believe will impact the economic outlook over the next several months.
The four that we are tracking are widespread testing, contact tracing, the capacity to treat patients in our hospitals, and therapeutics for COVID-19.
Matt calls them the four T's: testing, tracing, treating, and therapeutics.
We believe that the success of these initiatives will have a critical impact on the pace of the economic recovery. As of today, the consensus view is that the reopening is expected to lead to a strong and steady economic expansion. The first three key healthcare initiatives that we're tracking, that is testing, tracing, and the capacity to treat patients in our hospitals, if that goes well, that is critical to mitigating the second wave risk. A return to a national lockdown leading to a much slower recovery than consensus expects would be negative for risk assets and equity markets. On the other hand, a big upside potential to the consensus view is a medical breakthrough on the therapeutic side that would allow for reopening the economy faster than anticipated. A faster recovery would be positive for risk assets and equity markets.
So now that we've identified both potential downside and upside for markets, we'll shift to the first T, testing. Heidi Lawrence shared the latest stats for the United States.
We've seen the 7-day moving average in new cases flat again. Test positivity rates continue to move down to 9%, and the recent daily positive rates have hovered around the 4-5% range, but has recently upticked to the higher end of this range. Unlike a couple weeks ago, when we were seeing new hospitalizations, ICU admissions, and testing all moving in the right direction, we're now seeing states with growth in both new cases and hospitalizations in early June rise, as well as higher than average positive testing rates in states including Arizona, Arkansas, Utah, North Carolina, and South Carolina. And now Texas, too, is seeing a modest uptick in hospitalizations, along with a more meaningful uptick in new cases. States where new cases grew in the past week comprise about 40% of the total U.S. population, but less than 20% are in states with increases for both new cases and hospitalizations.
In this environment, Heidi says the focus is shifting to different methods of cost-effective testing.
Other methods used to support PCR testing, including antigen testing and potentially pooling of test samples, which are both more cost-effective ways of testing.
We should mention here that PCR stands for polymerase chain reaction, and PCR testing is considered to be the gold standard when it comes to detecting the COVID-19 virus. Anyway, back to Heidi.
We are increasingly optimistic that we can double our current capacity of 500 tests a day with these new approaches. Current estimates range from needing 1 to 3 tests a day to get back to work and school, all the way back up to 20 million tests a day, which seems a little high in our view. One of the challenges we need to address is the lack of coordination to get that testing to the regions of the country most in need and finding safe places to test. This will be critical in the fall, but we are definitely more prepared to address this issue than we were during the first wave.
Heidi's statement is supported by the latest testimony from Admiral Brett Girouard, Assistant Secretary for Health at the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services.
Federally qualified health centers serve over 29 million people across the nation. They provide care to 1 in 5 of those uninsured, 1 in 5 rural Americans, 1 in 3 living in poverty, and 1.3 million homeless. Again, to assure we reach these most vulnerable among us.
We also need to shift our mindset a bit from rationalizing the testing to exclusively high-risk individuals to what has been described as a more adaptive or customized approach to testing. You know, different settings might have a higher or lower risk tolerance and therefore different testing needs. For example, if you're working at a nursing home, your tolerance level for a less sensitive antigen test may be too low. Therefore, nursing home administrators would most likely use the highly accurate PCR test daily or weekly. If you're serving a low prevalence, low risk population, you might employ a tactic where you perform low cost antibody testing and use this information to continuously assess a population's level of immunity and increase social distancing measures accordingly. And so you're saving some money this way. Finally, if your employees are public facing, then you may employ a different diagnostic tool set for those folks than you do for the people in the back office. The key is not to find every single infection, but to try to avoid an outbreak. In terms of the debate over immunity and reinfection rates, those seem to be waning with a recent study coming out of Mount Sinai supporting the fact that individuals infected with COVID do produce antibodies, in contrast to studies coming out of Asia suggesting otherwise. But we're waiting more data over the summer and corresponding guidelines on what levels of antibodies constitute immunity. And I'm increasingly believing that there's some level of immunity transferred to a COVID patient, but whether it's 6 months or 18 months is still a question.
Tracing, the second T, is critical when it comes to suppressing a second wave. But, as Matt noted, contact tracing isn't widespread enough to be impactful.
While Google and Apple have launched their exposure notification apps for phones, utilization of these apps is not intuitive and the adoption thus far is low. So if tracing does not improve, that increases the likelihood that more patients will get infected and will show up in our hospital systems.
So if that second wave does come, how prepared are hospitals for more patients in need of care? Devesh offers his thoughts, starting with the critically important ICU wards.
About 15% of ICU beds are being utilized by COVID patients. And even in states like New York, where at one point we saw peak utilization of 150% of ICU beds, now that's actually fallen to the low 20s. So when you ask about the question regarding how prepared will these facilities be if there's a second wave, I think hospitals have taken the preventative step of firstly infrastructure changes, which is they've created dedicated rooms and potentially dedicated entryways and wings to stave off a second wave and not needing to shut down again. The other items that they've focused on is ensuring that they have adequate PPE, personal protective equipment, and other supplies that have been utilized during COVID treatments. The elective procedures will start coming back. I think hospitals have also thought about how they would bring these procedures back, thinking about more time between cleanings, which procedures to stage back first, make sure it's on a need basis, not on a revenue basis. There's also been a concern with how to deal with extended hours. So is there enough labor force? But I think hospitals have done a great job addressing this. So as they've added hours, they've also added potentially days, weekends, and evenings. But they've all definitely addressed this in order to take on the capacity and take on procedures that have been deferred since March and April. So with that all being said, they definitely addressed and thought about the second wave and would be very well prepared if there's a rise in cases again.
Okay, so we know that if a second wave comes, hospitals will need methods for treating patients. That brings us to our third T, therapeutics. Biopharma specialist Samantha frames the crisis in terms of how the duration of disruption to the healthcare system and the economy overall will be shaped by how quickly pharma and biotech can innovate.
because drugs can play such an important role in helping doctors better manage this disease. Right now, there are over 100 programs in development worldwide, which is really exciting. We're seeing all of biotech and pharma come together with new technologies and their best scientists. We're seeing government organizations collaborate, like the FDA and the National Institutes of Health, and important public-private partnerships, like the Gates Foundation and the Milken Institute. I spend a lot of time researching the COVID drug programs in development because I think their progress will be important for the market.
To break it down for us, Samantha says she separates drugs into four broad development buckets: antivirals, immunomodulators, therapeutic antibodies, and vaccines.
Antivirals are drugs that prevent virus from replicating and reduces symptoms. They're really most effective when they can be given early in the disease course. We had the first piece of good news in this pandemic about 6 weeks ago when the NIH announced positive results from a trial of remdesivir in severe hospitalized patients. It was able to reduce the time to recovery from 15 days to 11 days. When you think about how overwhelmed the healthcare system was and how capacity constrained the hospitals were, the ability to get patients better and out of the hospital by 4 days is really meaningful. And so I think about remdesivir as an important first tool in doctors' toolbox to manage the disease. Unfortunately, it's given intravenously, which I think will limit its broad appeal. There's another drug that Merck recently in-licensed that's going into phase two that's an oral antiviral. We should have data by the end of the summer. And if that's successful, I think it can be used on a much wider scale.
Which brings us to our second category, immunomodulators.
These reduce the inflammatory response. And when patients develop advanced COVID, literature suggests that they tend to die from something called acute respiratory distress syndrome, which is really an inflammatory response. There are two approved drugs on the market, one from Sanofi and one from Roche, which treat very similar symptoms to acute respiratory distress syndrome in different disease settings. So early proof of concept data with those drugs and COVID were very encouraging and are both in phase three trials, with data expected in the month of June. I think that could be an important second tool in doctors' toolbox to managing the disease.
Samantha says she and the Lord Abbott team have a differentiated view on the third class, therapeutic antibodies.
We're extremely constructive on this category. If people have been following the work done at Mount Sinai, where they've been using plasma from recovered patients to treat sick COVID patients, this concept is an age-old, tried-and-true practice because recovered patients have developed antibodies to the disease, and that's what allows them to get through it. Unfortunately, the amount of blood that's extracted from any one patient is really limited in how many patients it can help benefit. And so biotech has taken a very modern approach to this by isolating those antibodies and then producing them synthetically so they can scale up and manufacture on a much wider basis. And so there are four or five large pharmaceutical and biotech companies pursuing this, going into the clinic this month and over the summer. And I think by the early fall, we can start to see data from those trials. The reason I'm so excited by this is past efforts in other diseases using this approach have been very successful. And I think it's a bridge to a vaccine. I think it can be used for healthcare workers and at-risk populations in that period of time until vaccines are broadly available to the general population.
The fourth bucket, vaccines, is one we hear a lot about in the media.
Because vaccines can be prophylactic, meaning they prevent somebody from getting the disease, and they generally create or induce lifelong immunity. There are several programs that have been designated by the U.S. government under the auspices of Project Warp Speed. They'll be going into phase three trials this summer, and hopefully we'll have data within 8 to 9 months.
Another topic that is certainly top of mind in the age of the coronavirus pandemic, health insurance. Raleigh says this is especially an important issue, particularly if you consider the U.S. unemployment rate hovering around 13.3%.
You know, if you look at the stats, roughly half of Americans get health insurance from their employer. So it's a pretty meaningful number relative to other forms of healthcare coverage. So far, estimates suggest over 16 million workers have lost their employer-based coverage since mid-March. And if you add their dependents as well, that number is actually 27 million. So obviously there's a potential that that number could grow. But, you know, the good news is, though, that out of that 27 million, just under half will qualify for Medicaid coverage, and another 30% will likely qualify for marketplace subsidies through the Affordable Care Act. But that still leaves another 20%, or roughly 6 million people, who won't be eligible either under Medicaid or the Affordable Care Act, and would therefore have to pay the full cost of coverage or remain uninsured.
Are there alternatives? Morali says options like COBRA and short-term health plans can be expensive or only provide limited coverage.
Given that this is an election year, there generally is support to shore up some healthcare protections, but whether that is incorporated into new legislation or into another round of stimulus remains to be seen. So short term, it's basically status quo, where we work within the contours of our existing system, and any large scale changes to healthcare policy are really happening after the election.
When it comes to a longer term view, Devish has a few observations about supply chains and the changes in how care is administered.
Over the past decade, there's been a trend towards a lower number of vendors in order to consolidate purchasing. Given the COVID pandemic and the lack of supplies, this trend could reverse in order to ensure supplies, especially as it pertains to PPE. We've seen the cost of masks in certain cases move from 50 cents to $6. So in order to mitigate this risk, I think providers will likely look towards alternative sourcing, potentially moving supply chains away from only China to other geographies. Another trend that is likely to accelerate is providing care in alternative settings. Telemedicine and virtual care is likely to be a major shift. Even though telemedicine has been available for many years, utilization rates have been low since incentives were not there. Several items have changed, allowing for quicker adoption. Firstly, reimbursement rates in certain cases have seen a parity with office visit reimbursement. Also, infrastructure, be it bandwidth for video, security, privacy, has all been updated. The alternative settings would also be in terms of outpatient facilities, clinics, and urgent care facilities. These will see increased utilization as patients are fearful or apprehensive to go to an inpatient facility. These changes require capital and capabilities, and therefore we will likely see further consolidation as the well-capitalized providers continue to take share, either through M&A or build out of service lines.
Just an aside here, M&A stands for mergers and acquisitions, which describes ways companies can consolidate by either merging together or being acquired by another company. Now back to Devish.
We also see slightly better partnership with medical device manufacturers and government regulators. The first example is ventilators, where we saw various manufacturers being approved on an accelerated timeline.
Devish says another consideration is a shift in capital expenditures, how hospitals spend money. For example, hospitals may rethink adding a new wing and instead add new technology. And as Heidi notes, there are other developments with potentially positive implications for some of the companies she follows.
I also think that we're going to see an increase in funding, specifically from the NIH and other organizations in the areas of infectious disease, virology, and this could benefit a lot of the names in our group, including life science tools, diagnostics, pharmaceutical companies, biotech, and the CROs.
CRO stands for Contract Research Organization. They're companies that provide clinical trial and other research support services for the pharmaceutical and biotechnology industries. Now, on to the next question. What about regulatory changes to the biopharmaceutical industry? The team is tracking this quite closely. Samantha shares her thoughts on one area in particular.
There's a division of the Department of Health and Human Services called BARDA. It's the Biomedical Advanced Research and Development Authority. And it's really a part of the government that was designed to lead our nation and protect them from chemical or biological nuclear threats. And so this agency has been really proactive in funding a lot of the manufacturing scale up for the vaccine programs and development, because this is usually a rate limiting step once you've gone through positive clinical trials. And so they've given out significant funding to several companies, including Moderna, Sanofi, Johnson & Johnson, and the Oxford-AstraZeneca vaccine collaboration. So I think on one hand, when I think about regulation, I think if any of those vaccines are successful in coming to market, I don't think they'll really be able to set price in a normal competitive marketplace like you'd expect because they took government funding. So I think that's one implication of having ties to the government. On the flip side, I think the FDA has been extremely proactive and reached out to industry, meaning pharma and biotech, very early on when the crisis hit in March, to offer guidance and flexibility on how to conduct clinical trials during this pandemic. And it provided alternative means of monitoring patients, administering drugs. There even was some room to make changes to statistical plans in consultation with the FDA. I think that flexibility and the overall desire to get drugs to market faster will continue after this pandemic ends and will really be a positive lasting effect in terms of regulation.
On the equity side, Matt says another topic the group has discussed is the availability of financing for key constituents in the healthcare industry.
We've seen some of the smaller medical device companies and biotechnology companies access the equity markets to raise capital.
So how are fixed income markets functioning for the healthcare systems and hospitals that need access to capital? Morali weighs in here.
Well, I think the fixed income markets continue to remain favorable, really driven by robust technicals. Early on during the pandemic in late March and early April, you know, you had companies that were scrambling to maintain financial flexibility as they preemptively drew down on their revolvers and credit lines and placed new debt, all as liquidity enhancing measures. You had capital structures that were fully loaded with recovery scenarios, really only measuring liquidity through the end of 2020 with no real visibility into 21 and beyond. Since then, though, the reversal has largely been driven by an enormous amount of stimulus coupled with an accommodative Fed. Add to that broader signs of demand stabilization in late April and into early May, and we've seen spreads come in quite drastically, really across the credit spectrum from leveraged loans to high yield to investment grade debt. I think investor appetite for healthcare paper, especially hospitals, remains strong. And that's really driven by the government backstopping the sector with multiple rounds of assistance, both in the form of grants and low interest loans. So while markets have been quite resilient, really driven by technicals, I think once we get a better sense of what the second half of the year looks like, valuation should track more closely to fundamentals.
To wrap things up, what are the key coronavirus developments investors should be watching out for over the next few months? Heidi says testing rates will definitely be on her radar.
We'll be watching what the positive testing rates are in each region. And, you know, we feel that if those can go down or stay at the 3 to 5% ranges, we'd feel better about the level of transmission. You know, if we approach herd immunity in some states in 50 to 60%, and some states might get there faster than others, given they've already seen the brunt of COVID, then maybe we'd feel a little bit more comfortable and encouraged. And then finally, obviously, if we got a vaccine.
These are just some of the insights the team has on the healthcare industry. You can always get more on this and other topics by contacting your Lord Abbott representative and by visiting lordabbott.com. In the meantime, we're glad Matt, Heidi, Samantha, Devish, and Morali could share their thoughts on COVID-19 and the special edition of the Investment Conversation. Thank you for joining us. The investment professionals in this podcast cited information from the following sources: the April 3rd, 2020 edition of the McKinsey & Company COVID-19 Briefing Materials on Global Health and Crisis Response, the Evercore ISI COVID Tracker data as of June 10th, 2020, the Kaiser Family Foundation. Unless otherwise noted, all discussions are based on U.S. markets and U.S. monetary and fiscal policies. Asset allocation or diversification does not guarantee a profit or protect against financial loss in declining markets. No investing strategy can overcome all market volatility or guarantee future results. Market forecasts and projections are based on current market conditions and are subject to change without notice. Projections should not be considered a guarantee. This podcast may contain assumptions that are forward-looking statements, which are based on certain assumptions of future events. Actual events are difficult to predict and may differ from those assumed. There can be no assurance that forward-looking statements will materialize or that actual returns or results will not be materially different from those described here. This podcast serves as reference material and is provided for general educational purposes only. Does not constitute an offer to acquire, solicitation for an offer to acquire, an offer to sell, or solicitation for an offer to buy any securities, nor is intended to be relied upon as a forecast, research, or investment advice on any securities and cannot be used for any of the foregoing. The views and opinions expressed by the Lord Abbott speaker are those of the speaker as of the date of the broadcast, and do not necessarily represent the views of the firm as a whole. Any such views are subject to change at any time, based upon market or other conditions, and Lord Abbott disclaims any responsibility to update such views. Neither Lord Abbott nor the Lord Abbott speaker can be responsible for any direct or incidental loss incurred by applying any of the information offered. The value of investments and any income from them is not guaranteed and may fall as well as rise. Investment decisions should always be made based on an investor's specific financial needs, objectives, goals, time horizon, and risk tolerance. Please consult your investment professional for additional information concerning your specific situation. This podcast is copyright 2020 of Lord Abbott & Co., LLC. All rights reserved. This recording may not be reproduced in whole or in part or in any form without the permission of Lord Abbott. Note to European investors. This communication is issued in the United Kingdom and distributed throughout Europe by Lord Abbott UK Limited, a private limited company registered in England and Wales under company number 10804287, with its registered office at Talis Hall, with its registered office at Talis House, 2 Talis Street, Temple, London, United Kingdom, EC4YOAB, Lord Abbott UK Limited, FRN 783356, is an appointed representative of Duff & Phelps Securities Limited, FRN 466588, which is authorized and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. The information provided is not directed at any investor or category of investors and is provided solely as general information about Lord Abbott's products and services and to otherwise provide general investment education. None of the information provided should be regarded as a suggestion to engage in or refrain from any investment-related course of action, as neither Lord Abbott nor its affiliates are undertaking to provide impartial investment advice, act as an impartial advisor, or give advice in a fiduciary capacity. If you are an individual retirement investor, contact your financial advisor or other fiduciary about whether any given investment idea, strategy, product, or service may be appropriate for your circumstances.